Welcome, everyone, to a Baseball America podcast. Along with J.J. Cooper, I'm John Manuel. Thanks so much for joining us here on the podcast. We apologize for a couple of weeks without a podcast sponsored by MLB Network. And reminding
we
you
we had
that
the
you
college
can,
one. We had a few weeks since a professional.
We had two college ones, J.J.
But we had a professional NL West podcast that died twice. We had a computer die, and then the sound quality just was not
two lost
suitable.
Podcasts. One with me and you, one with you and Jim Callis. And Jim especially was waxing eloquent about the quality of the one that you guys did. And I know that you and I felt like we had a really good podcast in us.
Unfortunately, the quality of the one that he and I did was maybe the content was quality. The sound was not so much.
And Jim and JJ, that was also a pre-Super Bowl podcast. So we know that your spirits
were
high. So you are still here. And that was also a pre-UNC Duke game for me. So not quite the Super Bowl, but same week and the same genre, and both of our teams on the wrong end of that. So, but obviously we're here more to talk a little bit about the prospect handbook and minor league prospects as opposed to our other passions in our lives. But this is clearly a passion of ours, and if it's not a passion of yours, you really shouldn't work at Baseball America. Lucky for us, it is, and we're going to touch base on the NL West, but then we're going to kind of give you a little working – we still have a working list of the top 100. Top 100 will be released officially – at BaseballAmerica.com, February 23rd. So whenever you're listening to this, February 23rd, which is
day.
A Wednesday, is Top 100 Day. We'll chat a lot that day as well. I'm sure we'll tweet about it a lot as well.
It'll be a show.
Multimedia, attack from Baseball America on the Top 100. The only Top 100 that really matters. But we do, we should talk a little bit about the National League West. No one from the National League West is going to be at the top of the top 100 as far as like those jostling for those first couple of spots, JJ. But the top of the National League West for me remains really, to me, is the most fascinating division in baseball because there's so much change from year to year. You have the team that really, just in terms of market, should dominate the division is the Dodgers, but they don't act like a big market team.
Well, because they don't have a big market owner.
That's right. No, I mean, and they haven't ever since the McCourts took control there, and now there's one McCourt running things.
I was going to say there's a judge right now that says that both McCourts have a right to
this. That's right. And our own Bill Shakin, longtime BA correspondent, one of the correspondents who was around when I started at Baseball America in 1996 and still is around, he's done unbelievable coverage at the LA Times about the McCourt divorce. But with that, you have your defending World Series champions with the Giants. The Diamondbacks have won a World Series in recent history. Obviously, a very different franchise now than what they were at that time. The Rockies have won a pennant recently. And the Padres have actually been the most consistent team as far as competing every year the last 5 years. They're there just as often as anyone else, losing on the last day of the season this year, falling just short of their second playoff, game 163 in 3 years. They're kind of like the Twins of the NL West. They'd love to play those compete for that game 163. But obviously they've changed a lot this offseason, JJ. So to me the whole division is fascinating, and I still think the Dodgers, have had this run. The Dodgers and the Giants have had their success. They've had it's been a lot of homegrown success. The Dodgers, the core from that 2005 Top 100 or 2006
Six,
Top 100,
2006,
and was that the record for most teams in the Top 100 with 9?
It's tied with the Dodgers, the 91 Dodgers for
okay.
the most. Players in the top 100, 8.
Okay, 8 in the top 100 for the Dodgers that year. And then we also had the Giants, and it's well chronicled their homegrown pitching that led them. 6 homegrown pitchers on the staff in the World Series last year that were key to them winning the World Series. So to me, this time of year and analyzing these teams' prospects tells you a lot about what's going to happen in the future with their big league clubs, as much as any division.
It does, and I think
no one's outspending anybody in this division, is my point, to such a degree that it makes that much of a difference, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, took a round to bend the rear, but yes. that's what you're trying to say, is that no one...
You can tell it's been a few weeks since we podcasted.
Homegrown is the... homegrown talent is important. We say that, and the interesting thing with that is it's like the system that we look at as the best system out there among the NL West teams is one that's not really homegrown talent.
Right, the Padres.
And the Padres would not be, I don't think, we had the Padres in our top 10 as far as our org talent rankings for the prospect handbook. It's easily fair to say that you take away the Adrian Gonzalez trade and they're not anywhere close to the top 10.
Yeah, I don't think they were in the top 10. I mean, they had three of their top four prospects coming from the Red Sox in that trade. And then, they have interesting guys after that. I think there's a pretty big split. You know, we have Jeff Decker 7, Donovan Tate 8 in their list. Those two guys could not be more different. I mean, Jeff Decker, I mean, those guys are just 180 degrees from each other. The only things they have in common is they're both technically outfielders and they're both Padres. And I guess they're both human beings.
And you know what? I know I'm not decrying tools at all, but because tools are important. Because really what you're talking about there is this Jeff Decker is a guy who's hit, who if you took the hit tool away, if you took his offensive tools away, Jeff Decker would not be a baseball player.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, he might have been a pitcher.
Might have been a pitcher,
Montevero,
right.
Like
yes,
on the mound.
Excuse
back
me.
In his
might have been a pitcher. But as a position,
he's like a Terry Forster type pitcher, though.
But as an offensive player, you know, it the value's all in the bat.
Right. Oh, no.
And then Donovan Tate is the antithesis of that right now.
He never gets in the field, but when he does, I mean, he's so raw.
So
offensively,
and with those being the case, I'm not saying you don't take chances on high ceiling guys like that, but I will take the guy who's shown he can hit something.
Yeah, I don't think it's I think the story there is that Jeff Decker is so close to Donovan Tate.
Yeah,
there'd be a chasm between a guy like Decker who had a terrible first half, but then got hot when he was healthy, at the Cal League last year, and then Tate who's barely got on the field. Was raw when he was drafted, and on top of that, he's had multiple injuries. He had the broken jaw, he had the ATV accident.
And you do have to worry about that, because when you're talking about someone who was so raw, I was talking to someone about Tony Sanchez this year, and it's not really nearly as important as Sanchez, because he's a pretty polished player.
Right.
But the point that I was talking to a manager, a coach, and he said, those at-bats he loses, those don't come back. You will get those at-bats next year, but you would have had those at-bats next year anyway.
Right, and there's only so much you can do in instructional league.
Right, and in the case of Tate, those at-bats have gone away, and they're never coming back because now, instead of it being something where he's going to be ready for low A as ideally a 19-year-old.
Yeah, he's a 20-year-old already. He's 20.
And he's not ready for low A, probably.
Doesn't seem like he's ready for full season ball. This will be a pretty amazing spring. He'd have to have, a huge spring to go to Fort Wayne. Kind of an interesting side note here. He's probably going to be a big project for Pat Murphy, the former Arizona State coach, now helps run extended spring for the Padres and will manage their short season team. I would expect that Donovan Tate would go to short season Eugene and play for Pat Murphy.
But then when you talk about your concerns, you're saying if that happens, let's just map that out, that happens. We're talking that next year he'll be heading to low A as a 21-year-old.
Right. And that's not what you paid $6.25 million for, really. You can't get around the bonus.
No, right. It's a lot of bad luck for him because there's been a lot of injuries involved in that. But that's not what you were not – when you map it out, you don't say, hey, this tools the high school player that we drafted. We're expecting him to make full season ball in year
three.
Yeah.
No, you're right. And let's face it, he was not the consensus number three prospect in that draft. I mean, teams were
all over the board.
All over, but most of them were like, wow, this guy wants this much money, and we don't see him as that kind of player. And the Padres had a very high upside, a high risk draft in 2009, and we loved them for it, for taking some of those risks with Everett Williams, Donovan Tate, Kivas Sampson. So far, they've had injury issues with Sampson and with Tate, and Williams had a pretty poor first pro season. So, just kind of amazing, I think, and a little ironic. That was the draft. I think that was the draft, the highest grade, or if we gave grades, that was the draft that we liked best under Chief Gayton's administration as scouting director in San Diego, and he lost his job after that one. Whereas other drafts where we thought, really, Matt Bush, really, weren't as panned as instantly. We were instantly not high on Matt Bush, but we thought that was a good draft in 2009, and the early returns have not been very, very hot. But the rest of their list, I think, is kind of interesting. But you aren't going to see too many teams, like you said, that it's really not a homegrown top 10 when three of your top four guys come from outside the system.
We do have a question before I'm going to jump in.
Yeah, no,
we good. We do have questions. We hit our Twitter page.
At Baseball America is the general address. And one of them, and then I have one on the @JohnManuelBA, that refers to Simone Castro.
But I was going to go. The first one is how long before Anthony Rizzo is playing first base for the Padres on an everyday basis?
And Rizzo is pretty interesting because you know his story off the field is pretty compelling. Coming back from was it non-Hodgkin's lymphoma,
I believe,
where he missed most of a year, if not an entire year. But then he had a pretty huge year last year.
Had a big year, and he really had leaped over, I think it's safe to say,
Lars Anderson.
Had leaped over Lars Anderson, who he'd always been kind of the second first baseman prospect in the organization
right.
for the Red Sox.
Right.
And by the time he was traded away, you had to say that he was the first base prospect in the he was the top first base prospect in the Red Sox system. Not that the Red Sox, if you want to talk about a player who you can happily trade away in a deal,
right?
If you're getting Adrian Gonzalez, you can
absolutely.
If they wanted Lars Anderson too, they could have probably had him.
And before that, I mean, with Kevin Youkilis, if they'd signed Adrian Beltre as a free agent,
right,
he would have been somewhat extraneous as well. When you have Anderson ahead of you, who the Red Sox still profess to have some hope for, and then if Youkilis had stayed.
Obviously, now with Gonzalez gone, a little bit more wide open in San Diego for Rizzo to find a job.
Yeah, whatever happened to Kyle Blanks? You know, that's a guy who was on our top 100 a couple years ago. I think Kyle Blanks is a guy who we had on the top 100. Like, you just could not deny his performance. I don't think we were ever, 100% convinced that Kyle Blanks was the guy. And then he's obviously had some injury issues, and the last time we saw him in the major leagues, he was swinging and missing an awful lot. I think Kyle Blanks is ahead of him in the pecking order because he has big league time.
Right.
You hope he gets healthy. But clearly Anthony Rizzo was acquired to be a regular, and he had 25 home runs last year. Now, some of that, I think, is a little bit of a Portland mirage. Portland, Maine, has always had a home run haven park. It was 1 year back in the day when they were a Marlins affiliate, and Mark Kotze played there, and they have, I think, six guys at 20 home runs, including Kevin Millar and John Roscoe's. R-O-S-K-O-S. I'm sure it was Greek-American, but I never quite asked them that. Days before email, I didn't dash off an email to every player, hey, wait a minute, are you Greek? But I would have, I'm sure, if I'd had email in 1997, if he had. I think Anthony Rizzo is going to be their starter, but not in 2011. I think 2012 is reasonable, though, JJ. He'll go to AAA Tucson, their new Tucson affiliate this year.
And
seems like one full year of matriculation in AAA, and if he has a good year, the next year he's a cheap, low-cost, let's see what he's got kind of guy.
I think that's pretty fair to say. I wouldn't really disagree with you on that.
He also had the best defensive tool in the he won best defensive first baseman in the Eastern League, and that was despite the fact that he made 11 errors in the Eastern League, and I think he made 15 for the year. So he got a little sloppy defensively last year, but the managers and scouts we've talked to think that the defensive tools are there for him to be a very skilled and above average defensive first baseman.
Yeah,
what are other questions we have on the Twitter?
I was going to go back. I was trying to find Bluegart.
Bluegart, who's been a steady Twitter contributor for both my feed and for at Jim Callis BA. And by the way, if you're not already following, at JJ Coop 36, correct?
Yes, that is correct.
And I'm at John Manuel BA, and I'm desperately trying to catch back up to Aaron Fitt in the last two college podcasts.
Sorry.
We had quite a Twitter battle.
Sorry, but I think with college season that you're going to.
I don't know. We'll see. I'm right there with Aaron, so I think
this is a good time for him, though.
I tweet about college baseball. I have college baseball followers out there.
No, I know, but
he is. I think he's going to tweet a bit more about college baseball.
I'm just going to go out on a limb and say that.
Bluegart's question, if we're not finding it, was regarding the lining up top pitching prospects in the National League West, and without using our top 100 to cheat off of JJ, which we both participated in our top 100. Your options here are Jared Parker, number one prospect with Arizona, Tyler Matzek, number one with the Rockies, but he also wanted us to factor in Christian Friedrich, who's number four on that Rockies list. I don't believe he had us factoring in any of the Dodgers because they're so much further away, but then Casey Kelly with San Diego
and
Zach Wheeler.
And he said S. Perez, which I assume he meant Simon Castro, but
right.
I could be wrong.
Yeah, there's no S. Perez that I can see.
I don't think Salvador Perez, the Royals catcher, is part of this.
I don't think so either. And then Zach Wheeler for the Giants. I think it's amazing, JJ. It's smart, but it's amazing the Giants really don't have a treasure trove of pitching prospects. That's what we've been used to for
a
decade. But they don't need it.
Right. I was going to say they just graduated another part of the treasure trove last year.
Right,
and
right.
They've been graduating about one part of the treasure trove at least every other year for the last
seems
six,
like
so
yeah,
six
they
or
really
seven.
They have no need to have a depth of pitching prospects. And
it always never is a bad thing because you never know when injuries are going to crop up. But that being said.
Yeah, I mean, they have two pitchers in their top 10, and besides Zach Wheeler, the other guy is Eric Sirkamp, who's like a soft toss and lefty. I mean, I think that's actually smart of the Giants. I think we agree it's a pretty smart move for them not to to try to focus a little bit more on developing hitters. It makes a lot of sense for them. And their past approaches work, though, is why I'm surprised they deviated from it.
Well, I don't know if they – I mean, I don't know if necessarily you can say they've deviated from it as much as –
I think they have, though. At the top of their drafts, with the exception of Zach Wheeler, they've gone hitter heavy. I mean, like a guy like Carter Jerica was not – who's a third-rounder. He was not a premium guy for other teams.
I guess the best way to say, I guess you want to call that deviating. You could say also that they were trying to fix a problem they had,
right.
As much as deviating. It's not because they've also gotten a lot of pitching in later rounds.
That's true too.
They haven't. It hasn't always been. They've hit on a lot of first rounders.
That's true
but
too.
They also had the Jonathan Sanchez's of the world.
Just to me, when you bring it, when they changed scouting directors and John Barr took over the draft from Dick Tidrow, obviously Tidrow's still there. I think there was a pretty clear delineation that with John Barr, they've gone a little more hitter heavy and tried harder and done better at developing hitters.
Right, which they have to, because the reality is that if you want to say what part of what they did last year to win the World Series I think is sustainable,
yeah,
the pitching they had is very sustainable.
Pitching and Posey. That's about it.
If you ask what part is very hard to recreate, it's saying, hey, we're going to go out and get these veterans coming off of poor seasons and we'll figure out which ones of them are going to have great years this year.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's a little harder to do.
And I don't blame them for the kind of keeping the status quo this offseason, you know, not a lot of big splash moves over there, replacing Juan Uribe with Miguel Tejada, I guess is like their biggest move. But
so getting back, though, who do you have as the best pitching prospect in the NL West?
That's a tough question. I guess I'm still buying on the upside of Tyler Matzek, so I have him tops. But I'll tell you, I don't know what to think of Jerry Parker. I know he threw well in instructional league, but this is just a guy who he's not a big physical guy. You know, he throws a lot of pitches. He's been, you know, he's just not a big guy. He's a strikeout guy, so he's never going to be a pitch efficient guy. I just worry about Jerry Parker. So even though he's much further along than Tyler Matzek, and I understand that his upside is just as high as Tyler Matzek's, I still go with the younger, the left-hander. If there's a tie, I'll go to the left-hander and Matzek. But I can see why people would say Jerry Parker. For some reason, I'm not quite there on him as I might be on other Tommy John survivors.
I could see it too. I could see where you're coming from on Parker. At the same time, if you wanted to buy low on Parker, this is the time to, you know, to buy low on him. I mean, if you were rewinding this a couple of years and said, okay, this is Cal Drabek, which not, you know, maybe not the best comp in the world, but Parker's got a better arm. But what I'm saying is that when Drabek was coming off of that, you know, his surgery, it was something where there was a little less kind of notice, a little less mention going on about him.
That's true. I think that's not a bad analogy. There are a lot of Tommy John guys who do come back fine, and certainly Jerry Parker has come back fine as far as his stuff goes. You know, he apparently, if you believe what you read, it sounds like he's got a shot to. He's being given a shot to win a job of some kind in Arizona out of spring. How is that possible?
Well, I always take those with a grain of salt because you never tell a player, you very rarely tell a player, hey, you're just showing up here, but we're just letting you see the scenery and then you're going away.
But I mean, this is of all guys you're going to tell, this is the guy you would tell that to.
No, I understand.
The guy who hasn't pitched half a season at AA and missed all of last season.
But at the same time, it's also very easy to kind of dangle the carrot out in front of him and then, unless he doesn't allow
a
hit during the spring training, you say, okay, well, we need a little while longer here.
Well, his upside's always been, he's always been likened to Jake Peavy throughout his career, a very similar player. And that's pretty nice. That would be pretty nice upside if he has that kind of career. Even with Peavy always having been, kind of on the cusp of the good, not great. And he's had an ERA title. Did he win a Cy Young? Jake Peavy, I don't know if he won a Cy Young.
Off the top of my head, I'm not. You know, I should know that off the top of my head, but I don't want to misspeak. And
we don't obsess over the awards here unless they're our own. So we really don't.
I can tell you, he never won Baseball America Player of the Year. I can promise you that.
Jake Peavy has not won our Player of the Year award, but that Diamondback system, JJ, as we're naming Parker and Matzek as the top two guys there, I would take Friedrich and Simone Castro as the next two guys. That's a tough choice. I think I'd go Castro. But the wild card in all this is Zach Wheeler.
He has a
huge ceiling, but he really didn't do much last year.
It was a very interesting first full season.
Right.
Well, it was a very sporadic first full season, too. He had some And when you say injury problems is almost stretching it too far. He had more like fingernail issues
right.
and things like that that were that. But he had some command problems at times. He, you know, he only threw 59 innings for the entire season.
And
so
he walked 38 and, in that span.
Right, and he had outings that were great, and he had outings that were just ugly.
It's hard. It's hard for me to do this, but I think you need to do this when you evaluate Zach Wheeler, is to separate him from his draft class. I lump him in. Okay, 2009 first round pick. Shelby Miller, Jacob Turner, Tyler Matzek.
Right. And if you do that, he looks awful.
Yeah, especially compared to Miller or Turner. You know, Turner had a really nice year, got the
high A.
High
A, yeah.
And then Shelby Miller struck out 140 guys in 100 innings for the Cardinals in low A, and really looked like kind of the guy who set the really breakout in 2011. And Zach Wheeler is clearly behind those guys, even though he was drafted ahead of them at the time. So,
but at the same time, there's nothing in his season. He showed the same stuff. He showed
right.
flashes of dominance. So,
there were swing and miss stuff when you
right.
strike out
so,
70 guys.
So you could also say, hey, this year he could very easily, you could turn around half midway through the season and say he's right there with them.
I think he has as much of more projected than any of those guys. There's still something there as far as there's a gap between what he is and what he's going to be.
But
it's furthest for him.
This is why high school pitchers are a risky but wonderful commodity.
That's right. And the Giants, my money's on the Giants.
They usually figure out how to get those.
The ninja will figure it out. One day he'll appear behind he'll appear behind Zach Wheeler. He'll have some strange tincture that he comes up with, sprinkle it on that cracked fingernail, heal it up, and awful Zach Wheeler will go. But I also want to say on these pitching prospects, to me the Dodgers have some of the most intriguing ones. Because Chris Withrow and Ethan Martin, it wouldn't shock me if those two guys figured it out. And if one of them figured it out and really took off, it also wouldn't shock me if neither of those guys ever made it to the big league.
Right. I mean, that's the big question. And the reality of it is that Dodgers list, looking at it, there's a lot of guys on that list that you could say something very similar about that.
Yeah, Ruby De La Rosa. I mean, one of the hardest throwers in the minor
league. I love Ruby De La Rosa.
I think out of our – now I'm letting a little cat out of the bag here. Out of our top 100 players, Ruby De La Rosa has the lowest signing bonus on the entire list at $15,000. A little research tidbit for Ben Badler, master of international signings information.
Well,
but really, Ruby De La Rosa for $15,000 is pretty good.
Well, and I've made this point before, but the Dodgers' top 10 – their number, De La Rosa's number 3, Alan Webster 5, Jerry Sands 6.
That's right.
$40,000 for the three of them.
Yeah, and Alan Webster, that's another one of those young, high upside pitching prospects that I'm a fan of. And a little tidbit about the area scout there, Lon Joyce, who signed both Alan Webster and Jerry Sands. He was a junior college coach at Spartanburg Methodist. He coached Reggie Sanders there, among other players. So. He's had his hands in scouting and player development for a long time, and he's pretty good at it. So when his name's on a player, that's a good name to have on a player. JJ, a couple, like we just mentioned, Ruby De La Rosa's on the back of our top 100. We won't give away where. Let's transition from the NL West into our top 100.
So,
like we said, we'll have another podcast about
right, this is the
divulging.
This is how's the sausage made kind of
right.
part of the top 100. Next week we will have the top 100's out. Let's explain some of our more contentious points that we, you know, what players did we discuss for the longest, that kind of thing. But
yeah, I mean, and this was your first top 100 meeting, correct?
Right.
Your first time putting together your own prelim 150 and then being there for the
actual. It's funny, I've been here now for, this is year eight.
8 years, yeah.
Yeah, this is year eight. But this was the first year that I've done a lot of web stuff. I've done a lot of the, you know, well, I'm not going to say indie stuff. That's just a little.
But you've gathered a lot of the information that goes into it,
right?
Well,
I'd never been really, as far as the talking to scouts, all that. That was never a primary enough part of my job where I felt like that my 150 was going to have enough of a perspective to do it,
right?
And this year it's like, okay, I have done enough during the year and all where I feel like that I can put a 150 out there that I can defend and feel comfortable about, and that's it's something where. I think, you know, if you're hearing this and listening to it and going, oh, you know, well, that wouldn't be that hard to do, sit down and try to put together a personal 150. It's very involved.
It is not as easy as it seems, especially when you're getting past 50 or 60 this year. For me, it was around 40, 45 this year. There's just not a lot of difference in those kinds of players. You can either go all upside or you can go a little less upside and try to be more conservative about it, or you can try to mix the two together. I kind of try to mix the two, and I kind of have like when I go for my 50, my top 50, toward the end of my 50, I try to go upside to squeeze those into the handbook. And then 51 to 60, 51 to 75 or so, that's usually a little bit more conservative list. But then the back of my 100 again is more upside guys, with rare exceptions like a Brent Morrell.
And there are certain things that's funny, but we did our dream draft last year, which I thought was a wonderful exercise.
That was fun as well.
That where we basically had everyone, the staff, kind of get together, and we just picked teams from the top. But really, we picked like the top 300 prospects.
It was like picking your own farm system. Like, right. You're starting with your club, and you pick a farm system.
And there are certain things I did with that I kind of carry over when I was doing my personal 150 to take in, which one of the things is, and I think you agree with me on this, is I believe in the – when I'm talking about pitchers, I believe in the fastball.
Yeah.
And when it comes down to it, if I'm looking at two pitchers – and one of them has a plus fastball or a plus-plus fastball, and the other one's an average fastball, I'm generally going to go with the guy with the plus fastball.
Pretty
especially,
reasonable.
You know, again, when we're talking about Ruby De La Rosa. Ruby De La Rosa is a ceiling pick. There's no doubt about that. But I think I was one of the highest in the office on him because
he throws 100 miles an hour.
He throws 100 miles an hour.
Yeah.
And the reality of it is that not that every guy who throws 100 miles an hour works out, but you know what?
He's got a little wiggle room there.
Your little safety net under you is a little better when you throw 100. If you throw 100 and you lose a little velo, no big deal. If you throw 100 and your command doesn't really come together, okay, so you just end up being that scary guy in the bullpen.
Right, exactly.
Whereas if you throw 91 and you lose a little velo, you're probably not making the big leagues. If you throw 91 and your command wavers some.
Especially if you're right-handed. Yeah, Jim Callis and I were talking today, and he said there's a scouting director who insists to him all the time that the average fastball velocity of a big league left-hander is 88 miles an hour. Now, I haven't looked that up. I'm sure that's not true anymore now that when you factor in bullpenning. But maybe for a major league starting
left-hander. And it's also not true. The interesting thing is that this is a story I want to do at some point this year. Throw out topics that I'll try to work on this year.
Okay.
But the guns have changed. So when you say 88 before, are you talking about – because Stalker came out with a new, more precise gun that registers about a mile an hour faster.
That's all on where you measure it coming out of the hand.
And they keep measuring it closer and closer out of the hand because they keep getting more precise. And so with that, it's 1 to 2 miles an hour faster. And so the interesting thing with that is that there are teams that on their scouting reports, you have to make the notation
which gun you're using
because – you want to compare apples to apples, and if you're scouting a guy with the new gun and then someone else is scouting with the old gun, well, then you're not comparing apples to apples. So
we have one of each. We have one new stalker and one old stalker.
So. Right. And so that's another thing but even if it was 88 before, now it's like 89.
Right. No one's using the jugs anymore. Not to my knowledge.
It's a lot more stalker now, definitely.
I think the stalker has become the industry standard has become the stalker too, which is also the one that gives you the exit velocity off the bat. Which will be fascinating to watch this year with the new metal bats in college baseball. That's one thing I'll be watching.
The velocity is going to be going down
when I go to a college game. I don't usually use the radar gun, but when I go, I'll be looking this year. This is a little aside, obviously, we're talking about radar guns, but the exit velocity is always fascinating to watch on this.
So what we do is I think we had six
people submitted this year with Matt Eddy. Submitting more of 100,
he's knee deep in Super Register right now.
Right,
so
but Matt's also is kind of a novel approach. I won't give away Matt's approach, but Matt's approach was a little bit different from the rest of ours.
And he spelled it out like, "Hey, here's how I'm going to try this." And
right. It's kind of almost a formula, really.
But so what we did then is you take those six 150s and you put them together, and Jim Callis takes them and puts them in a spreadsheet, and you essentially get. 100, how you want to put it, but 150 points for one.
Yeah, 151 points, I think, is what it was.
And then it goes down to your 150th guy gets you a point.
Yeah,
so
we had 191 players, I believe, receive votes,
which
is also kind of fascinating. That's one of my favorite exercises, is just to see just who got votes. How many Royals did you have in your 150, JJ? Was it 12?
I think it was 12 in my 150.
13,
I think Collins was the last one in my 150.
So he was your 13.
That would have been 13, yeah. Yeah, because I had Eibner, I had Aaron Crow. So that would have been – Jeffress was in there. So
I don't remember how many those guys I wound up ranking. I know I came close to ranking almost as many Braves, actually, because I do like the Braves pitching depth, and I ranked a decent amount of Rays as well. And I did not – I got into my 130s or 140s before I ranked the Brewer. No offense, Mark Rogers. Great interview. He'd be my top 100 interviews, no doubt. He's getting a workout this offseason with interviews when it comes to being the Brewers and his comeback and all that kind of stuff. But I don't think there's a lot of surprises in our top 100, well, JJ, but I do think that one of the things that's interesting is the Royals are making a pretty strong run at that all-time record. And we've talked about this before in the offseason. Pretty easy call. They're our number one. But I guess the best thing about all their guys who are top 100 guys is they're all toward the top.
Right. And that's one of the things that we'll give credit to a report that came out today. I've been reading Scott McKinney, who does some posting kind of all around, but one of the main places he posts over is at Royals Review. And he did a study of essentially taking our top 100 from 1990 to 2003, I think it was, and looking at it. And one of the things that jumped out, he's looking at success rate compared to guys who don't make it and things like that, and is that there's a pretty big distinction between a guy in the top 20 compared to a guy in the top 40, and then there's not nearly as much distinction between a guy who's, say, number 41 versus 100 compared to the difference between guy number 40 and guy number 1.
Which is fascinating to read just because having just done this,
that
Jim
fits
Callis
exactly
said,
what I think.
It fits exactly what I think, and it also fits what Jim says going into it always. Is like, you know, because we were working on it, he asked me, have you started working on your 51 to 150 yet? Because we all did, the three of us had done 50s for the book. I said, not yet. And he's like, I don't waste too much time on it. He's like, you know, make sure you get the right names, but the order is just not that big of a difference.
Well,
he wanted to stress, like, make sure you just get the right players. And don't sweat the order too much. And then we did do some significant
tweaking
in the meeting.
When we get in the meeting, we sweat the order very significantly. And a lot of what ends up happening is you look at it and it's like, okay, we had this group. And again, I'm not going to get into names yet. We'll discuss that. But we had this group of middle infielders.
Right.
And you would be comparing guys. It's like, okay, this guy's got a good bat, but he's probably going to have to move to second. He's shortstop now. You got this guy over here who can really play it, you know, pick it defensively.
Right.
There's questions about the bat.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, you had all that kind of stuff, and you've got to, okay, now let's order this. Or is this catcher really 10 spots better or 20 spots better than this guy?
Exactly.
We do. I mean, we sweat the nitty-gritty on that.
It's once that spreadsheet comes out that we really get into the details and we start getting granular about it.
Right. But that being said, the interesting thing about it was is that that top 20 flew by.
It does every year. We there might be individual differences of opinion here or there, but in general, that top 20 to 25 are guys you can live with. That's an order you can live with when it gets averaged out.
Because the top 20 to 25 guys are the guys who have great tools,
combined
with excellent performance,
and
combined with generally, they're either almost like considered one of the best prospects to come out in years, or they're a guy who's done it in full season ball.
It's either guys who've done it in full season ball, or guys who are maybe one of the top 3, 4, 5 players in the previous year's draft. And it depends from draft to draft. And with last year's draft, it was almost a slam dunk. There are going to be three guys, Machado, Tyone, and Harper, of course, who were going to rank really high on the top 100. And after that, it was anybody's guess, A, who would be the next ranked guy on our top 100, and B, how high that player would rank.
Right.
I think that's fascinating.
Once you take those guys out of it, really pretty much everyone else in the top 20 is the guy who you can say has, to use a bad term, but has earned their spot there because they combine tools, because you can't get in the top 20 without tools.
Yeah.
But they've combined tools with performance.
Yeah,
and those
Decker,
are the guys.
Jeff Decker need not apply.
And that right there, that's why, and I'm not surprised at all to see that, you know, if you look back historically over our, you know, from 1990 to 2003, that was true, that the top 20 guys hit a lot more often, and they become stars a lot more often.
Right.
Well, that makes sense. And
there's the guy with the biggest tools. Yeah, no doubt.
And one of the things that, I mean, we understand the importance. When we get into that meeting, it's a pretty detailed meeting, partly because we know Baseball America has been putting out a top 100 now for this will be
22nd year
the 22nd top 100 we've done.
It's hard to believe.
You've gotten to the point now where there are very few players left in baseball from the first one.
Who would have come up? Yeah, the first one. I don't think there's anybody left. Because that was the year before Chipper was drafted.
I was going to say, that's the before Chipper. So is
89 draft guys. I mean, King Griffey Jr. was 87 draft, just retired. 89, Ben McDonald is the defining member of that draft, obviously long gone. I'm sure there are other 89 players who last long. But 1990 was Frank Thomas.
I bet you I'm going to find at least someone. That's my
That'll be fascinating. One of the other parts of this, as JJ's looking that up, as we're trying to answer our own question, but you know, we've done other features the last few years. You talked about the dream draft. We've done the split decisions. We've done risk factors. One of the things that I almost wish I had done this before I did my top 150 was looking at risk factors, and you're trying to find comparable players. You know, for a guy like, say, an Aaron Hicks, he's a top 100 player, was number one prospect for the Twins for 2 years. This year moved down to number two. And you're trying to find someone like an Aaron Hicks who repeated low Class A, JJ. I had to go back 20 years, through 20 years of top 100 history, to find a player who was ranked in our top 100 the year after he repeated low Class A for a full season. And I already mentioned him in this podcast. Reggie Sanders was the last guy who did that. And finding a lot of other guys who had repeated low Class A, but we didn't rank them as top prospects after repeating low Class A. Guys like a Mike Cameron, Chris Young, who were top 100 prospects later. Preston Wilson was another guy who I think actually had repeated low A and been ranked, but a very different player from Aaron Hicks in that he was hacktastic as opposed to Aaron Hicks, who draws a lot of walks. So
the answer
I like
that,
the risk factors.
That answer to that question is, on first glance, is no. There's no one left from our original top 100 who's still very recently there have been. But
how about Atlantic League? Any Atlantic Leaguers in that list?
Jose Offman, I think, is no longer in the Atlantic League.
Canseco, no. Obviously, a little bit of the big
we have deceased players who are on our top.
Greg Vaughn, whose son did not get mentioned in this year's top
100. Delino DeShields, whose son is in. You know, we have a lot of sons. We have more sons than we do. But
yeah.
Frank Thomas recently retired, but is obviously no longer playing. Larry Walker recently retired, no longer.
A lot of minor league coaches.
A lot of minor league coaches. A lot of minor league coaches.
Nico Bronya, who just was farm director for like 2 weeks for the Diamondbacks this offseason, has already done some scouting. Eric Karros, you're a fair-haired broadcaster.
But no, it does appear that there's no one left from the original Baseball America Top 100 who's still kicking around.
Tyler Houston, awesome.
Russ Springer, I was going to say, Russ Springer is no longer.
He just retired this offseason.
That would have been the last one.
He was the last guy.
Russ Springer, number 96 on that.
Shut the light, Russ Springer.
I say technically, yeah, he retired after Thomas and all, so yeah, he would have been the.
Yeah, because it was just this offseason that he went ahead and decided not to
come
back for spring
training. That is fascinating. That I know it's 22 years, and 22 years is a long time, but we can rank guys. There are guys who are ranked who are 4 or 5 years away from the big league, so.
Yeah, absolutely. But that's one of the things that I found is in this track record of ranking guys who repeat low A, guys who start slow, not a lot of those guys in the history of our top 100. Also, not a lot of guys who've repeated who are two-year rookie ball guys like Donovan Tate might be. Not a lot of those guys who've been top 100 guys. Donovan Tate.
I think that makes sense because.
Or guys like a Michael Ynoa who, we fed some of the Michael Ynoa hype. I think $4.25 million feeds that hype. What was he, number 54 the year that he got that money? He's in the 100.
We have to admit, the track record on those guys is not good.
Yes, that's correct.
If you say track record on ranking a Latin player who has yet to play pro ball, who got a lot of money.
I don't know that we ever ranked any of those guys in the top 100 before, to be honest with you, who had never played and gotten a lot of money. I don't think we even ranked.
Yeah, but I'm thinking back to the – maybe not before they play, but I'm thinking back to the Jose Pets. I'm thinking back to the Jose Pet.
But we ranked Ynoa before he ever played.
Right. No, I know. But Pet was ranked pretty quickly. Who was the outfielder who played for the Reds for a while, Yankees?
Oh, Jackson Maleon.
Jackson Maleon was ranked pretty
– I don't think he was in the top 100 of the year that he signed. I'm sure he was in. What year is that you found him?
Because
he signed in 1996.
This is 2000, so he was in.
Was he in the 97 list?
Let's see here. Sorry, I know this is that 97 list. He was there. He was number 40.
Wow. Well, that $1.6 million was the reason why. I mean, that was the biggest signing bonus. Almost like it almost doubled. I think the largest international signing bonus.
The track record on that, and hey, I can defend that. In that, at the same time, while the track record is not good,
just think
you are
it.
Ranking a combination. One of the ways to put it when we do a top 100 is every team does this differently, but teams, when they rank, are not always necessarily ranking. It's that combination of ceiling and floor, and different teams weight that differently.
Right, right.
But we're not necessarily always ranking. It's not just here are the guys who are most likely to make it to the big leagues and be solid big leaguers. There's a guy who may not make it but has more value because teams are willing to take that gamble on
right.
the possibility of being an all-star.
And
teams want all-stars, not solid seventh-inning relievers.
Yeah, and Maleon was a, you know, he got $400,000 less than the first overall pick in that draft, Chris Benson. I mean, that was a lot of money back then. So, I mean, it's a lot of money now. It was a lot of money back then. And I think it just tells you how outsized for the market that signing was. And I did not remember that he ranked that high, though, in the top 100 this first year.
As someone who's been in those meetings many, many years now,
Only six years. I was never in before I was editor-in-chief. I was always the college guy.
I was never
allowed in. I was a college guy. I was too busy.
Well, over those six years, was this one of the easier ones, did you think? Or
no, actually, I think it was one of the tougher ones because there was more dispute and there were more groups of players. Like you said, those middle infielders.
Those definitely also, middle infielders, catchers.
Yeah, and also this year's draft class was lackluster. So some of the players who we talked about including, like Yasmani Grandal or Zach Cox, I don't remember if all these guys made it in. Who was the or Zach Lee, Drew Pomeranz, Anthony Renato, those kind of guys, your top picks plus your guys who get the largest signing bonuses, those are really touchy guys of how to rank. There was not a lot of consensus. People who are involved with the draft, like Jim and like me, are generally going to, I think, rank those guys higher. Maybe other people
right,
in the
staff like I was,
would.
Yeah, for instance, than me.
Right,
A lot of those guys, there is somewhat a feeling on my end. Obviously, I know a little. I've not been talking to scouts about them
right.
all leading up to the draft that would help me kind of feel more in touch with them. But at the same time, with the guys who have some clear flaws, I think that I'm more likely to put them a little lower, saying, okay, let's see something.
Well, like on the risk factors, I'm going to end up doing this for my next column. You know, I tried to find another college hitter who had similar power numbers as Zach Cox. And I don't mean to be all Matt Eddie about it, but the guy had like a 180 isolated power in college in 2010. And that's the Southeastern Conference, and he hit 429. I mean, he didn't just – it wasn't like a low ISO on a 330 batting average. He stung the ball all year. He just was really more of a singles and doubles guy. I mean, I think he only had like 11 doubles to go with his 9 home runs. But a 610 slugging percentage on a 429 batting average, that just really struck me. And I went through first-round picks and top 100 prospect college hitters for like the last 10 years, JJ. I didn't want to go before 1998 because that's when the bats changed.
That's a different bat. Different stats. Back then, if you didn't have an ISO power.
I could have had a 180 ISO power with my bat speed. So, I mean, so
you're saying you have a slow pull.
That's what I'm saying. So Zach Cox, you know, the guys who I found who had similar ISO powers and were high draft picks were guys like Cliff Pennington and Russ Adams, guys who stole a lot more bases or played the middle of the diamond. And Zach Cox is at a corner. And, you know, that's a leap of faith for me that I wasn't 100% ready to take. Jim Callis, meanwhile, really believes strongly in Zach Cox's bat. And there's good reason to do that. He hit a lot of home runs as a freshman. He hit a lot of home runs as a freshman in the
Cape. And he did hit 429.
And then he hit 429 in the SEC last year. I mean, he's been on the big stage. He played in Omaha as a freshman. People liked him out of high school. I think one of Jim's points was that when he was in high school, not Jim, Zach Cox, that Zach Cox was our number two or number three.
When Jim was in high school, Zach Cox was not born.
That's right. Yes, sad news for Jim. But when Zach Cox was coming out of high school, I think he was number two or number three, I forget what it was, on our best power among the high school class that year. So he's, you know, scouts have always thought the power's there. This is not Sean Burroughs where he's never even flashed the power.
Sean Burroughs, it's fair to say that whenever a scout now says, oh, the power will come,
Sean Burroughs.
You can't help, but you have to think in your head, well, that was, you know, Sean Burroughs, that power never, you know.
Never
it stayed missing.
It never flashed. It was a.
Now, at the same time, the other guy that you have to if you track back not long after that, Joe Maurer was, will the power come? It's like in Scott
he was.
Says, will
it,
the power come?
So far,
and
it only came for 1 year.
It came for 1 year.
But he also is a batting champion three times, so who cares how much power the guy hits for, really?
Well, and he's a gold glove catcher. Who,
yes,
but,
on top of that.
But the power has shown some flashes of coming, too, because he did have an MVP caliber season where he hit 24 home runs.
And, yeah, 40-some doubles as well.
Right.
I mean, the guy's just a pure hitter and more of a pure hitter than Zach Cox or any of these guys we're talking about. But, yeah, I mean, you're talking about – so that was a tough one for me to rank. And so there's that difference. You have the draft differences, I think, that are going to come up. You know, sometimes when you rank an organization, for example, I ranked the Yankees prospects higher than other people did this year. You know, it just happens. I'm not a Yankees fan. But I've done their. I like their farm system right now, and I'm more bullish on it than Jim or than Will Lingo, or than I think anyone else on the staff is.
Well, but also there's things we also try to. One of the things we try to do is just look and compare guys. One of the again, I will bring up one other kind of. We'll get into specifics a little bit at least. Mm-hmm. When we went into the meeting, there was Manny Machado and Gary Sanchez.
Yeah,
and we both are kind of on the same side on this in that. We don't see a whole lot of separation between those two.
Not saying that Machado shouldn't be higher. I'm pretty sure I rank Machado higher.
But the key word is I don't think either of us thought there should be a giant separation.
Yeah, and you know, Machado, their ages are similar. They both play premium positions. They're both offensive players.
And they're both considered tool sheds.
Yeah, absolutely. And I can see Machado ranking higher. But, you know, Gary Sanchez, Machado got $6 million, whatever he got. Well, Sanchez got $3 million on the international market. It's a pretty high bonus.
Which $3 million on the international market is the equivalent of like $5 million on the U.S.
Yeah, it's one of the top five bonuses in the history of international signing bonuses. So among amateurs, anyway, you're not mm-hmm. talking about Japanese
right.
or Cubans. Like, and I think that's actually one thing that's interesting. That I'm pretty sure JJ, if you look at our entire top 100, because of his $16+ million bonus, Aroldis Chapman helps skew the average signing bonus. But I think the whole top 100 is over $1 million. Which is kind of startling. I think it's close to $1 million. It may even be.
I'd be interested what the median is on that. Yeah.
Yeah, I think actually it's 50 guys on our top 100 got $1 million or more.
Okay, so the median.
And 50 got below $1 million, which is kind of fascinating as well. And it's right at 50 on that top 100. But Sanchez and Machado, that was a difference, an argument that we lost, mind you, on that they should be closer together than they were. But to me, they're pretty similar prospect profiles as far as. Age again up the middle, offensive potential.
And the thing with that is you can argue it both ways. You can
argue Machado will be a better defender at short than Sanchez will be at catcher. But I think Sanchez can stay behind the plate.
And if you wanted to, you can argue. You can say, hey, the track record with big bonus Latin players who are still very young in their career.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Sanchez is very early in his career. Basically, he's played. I know he came up, but essentially spent the season in the GCL.
Right.
Is not very good. You know, ranking those guys too aggressively is not very good.
Yeah, for every Jesus Montero, there's a, you know, Joel Guzman.
At the same time, though, you don't want to say, I think both of us looked at it and said, okay, yes, you know more about Manny Machado because he was in the U.S., but not light years more. Gary
right.
Sanchez has had a full pro season.
Right.
Manny Machado has been scouted more extensively before he signed.
We've seen Gary Sanchez play extensively with a wood bat.
Right.
We have not seen that out of Manny Machado. That's the big difference for me is that's the biggest.
In a non-showcase, yeah.
Right, setting. Yeah. And that's the biggest thing to take a high school kid and put him in pro ball is you're taking him into that grind and you're taking him with a metal bat into a wood bat. And you can talk about evaluating, you know, guys at these showcases or with a wood bat all you want when they're amateurs. It's just a different deal when they're professionals and they're facing real velocity. And we've seen that with Gary Sanchez and
Thrive. But like, here's the key thing. Not even just facing real velocity.
Real
because I was going to say, because showcase, you're going to see real velocity.
You're
but
right.
The reality of it is that the pitchers at showcases – no, really what you're looking at, you're not trying to set up a hitter as much as you are. You need to show that velocity.
Right. I don't think guys are trying to set up hitters in the GCL either. They might be trying, but most of them
they're
don't
trying.
Know how.
They're not. They don't know how. But
just the quality of the play is
but,
so much
but
higher.
The point I'm making, though, is that you're going to see it, showcase ball is a little bit of a different animal.
No doubt.
You're
no
you're
doubt
throwing to
it.
The gun. You need to show. You need to show you can spin something.
You go have a great weekend.
Right.
If you're a hitter or a pitcher.
Whereas.
I won't get
when
it
we're
done.
Talking about,
yeah.
Okay, when you go to the Midwest League or the South Atlantic League, it's not a matter of having a good inning. It's a matter of having a good month.
And personally, I think it matters to perform well in the Gulf Coast League to an extent just because that's a very difficult environment to perform in.
Right.
Nobody's
I
there.
Think it's you get bonus credit almost.
Yeah,
it's
that's
not,
what it
it's
is.
Not, it's,
if you don't perform,
we will,
that's fine.
you have to write it off somewhat if a guy doesn't perform in the GCL, because the track record of guys who failed in the GCL who went on to succeed is a very lengthy list.
Absolutely.
Chipper Jones is kind of the patron saint of that.
Sure.
But at the same time, you don't then just say, well, let's disregard what he did when a guy is dominant in the GCL.
And by the way, you mentioned Chipper. I'm going back on another tangent. Call up that 1991 Top 100, by the way, the year Chipper was drafted. That's one that we'd just as soon forget. Todd Van Floppel, as I like to call him. Todd Van Poppel, 14th overall pick, but he did get this crazy bonus that year. He's our number one. How about Andujar Cedeño at two? This will never happen again. I looked up, and I saw Andujar Cedeño in 1990, or 89, I think it was, actually. Summer, he was in Asheville in the South Atlantic League. That's when I moved to Asheville. And the next year, in 1990, he jumped from Asheville to Double A in the Southern League. And he had double figures and doubles, triples, home runs. He did not have double figures in stolen bases, JJ, because he went 6-for-16 stealing bases. And this is something that will never happen. This is where you have to give credit, where credit is due to the Bill Jameses and the people who think, okay, walks matter, and guys who strike out a lot more than they walk, it's harder for them to repeat their performance. And, I mean, Andujar Cedeño had a big league career.
Right.
Late Andujar Cedeño. But look, we'll never rank a guy number two who had a 135-33 strikeout-to-walk ratio. It'll never, ever happen again. He had a sub-300 on-base percentage that year.
And that is when they
learned,
say...
I mean, obviously, you and I were in college at that time.
We were reading Baseball America.
Right.
We weren't...
I actually did not even know what the hell Baseball America was.
I don't know if I was subscribing, but I was picking it up at the UGA bookstore every...
I was looking for the ACC basketball equivalent, the poop sheet. That was my Baseball America back then.
But
we'll never do that again.
And that's what one thing I will say is that in that study that Scott McKinney did, one of the points is that is his prospect ranking better now than it was then. He said, I don't see a whole lot of evidence of it in looking at 1990 to 2003. And that's interesting. Maybe that's true, but at the same time, we do know a whole lot more than, and that's not knocking, you know, Allen and everyone who put together that 1991 list. There was a lot less information that had been disseminated at that point as far as understood.
And that 91, so those top two look bad, but look at the rest of that top 10. Ryan Klesko, Jose Offerman. Now, Roger Salkel got hurt, but Arthur Rhodes still active. Ivan Rodriguez.
Yeah, if Arthur had been on the list the year before, he would be the guy who's still kicking around.
Reggie Sanders. You had Bernie Williams down there at 11.
Mo Vaughn was 10, who had a solid, you know.
I missed because it was Maurice. Rondell White, Raul Mondesi. There are a lot of long career
Tino
guys.
Martinez. And...
That's a pretty good list. You know, the top two is wrong, but the rest of that list is pretty outstanding. And even Todd Van Poppel had a long major career, and Andujar Cedeño got to the big leagues.
And to also be fair, you go to like 1993, which
Chipper
is not
Cooler,
long,
I believe.
And it was Chipper Jones one, okay. Brian Taylor, who was just about to ready to blow, you know, have his shoulder destroyed.
Here's Cliff Floyd.
Cliff Floyd, Carlos Delgado, Tim Salmon, Will Cordero, Todd Van Poppel again. We couldn't rank that Todd Van Poppel.
Will not die.
But that top right there, Manny Ramirez, 13. That you could build a Hall of Fame wing out of.
Yeah,
some
Manny
of the guys
Ramirez.
That
was right before his minor league player of the year season, by the way, in '93. So, yeah, I mean the track record's pretty good. We'll definitely stack our track record up. The only reason that you're even listening to this podcast, you know who we are. It wasn't because of any brilliant marketing campaign. I can guarantee you of that. It was because of
the
track record of doing these things well.
And if we're looking on this, if you didn't know on our site, if you go on the drop downs, prospects, rankings, we have our all-time top 100 on there.
Make room for 2010.
Yeah.
Got to stick 2010 on there now that's history.
That's history now.
As 2011 getting ready to take its place up at the top. Last thing, JJ, just with the top 100, did you have a personal cheese ball? I have to ask. Trademark phrase of mine, obviously. But did you have any personal cheese balls in your 150 who you didn't really even realize maybe? That's when you were a lot higher on than everyone else was.
We talked about Ruby.
Oh, yeah, Ruby De La Rosa.
There may have been a couple others, but that's one that just sticks out in my mind was Ruby De La Rosa. Like, when we did the rankings, I think there was one person who didn't have him on his top 150. And,
that's possible.
And I think I had him, I'm pretty sure, in my top 100. So that
would
be.
He wound up in the top
100.
Right,
so,
I won't say where, but he wound up in the top 100. Like I said, I think I was higher on the Yankees guys than most people were. There was somebody, I wish I could remember, I wish I'd prepared for this podcast a little bit better. There was somebody
preparation, huh?
That's not what I do. But there was someone that I had, I got 110 or so, I don't think anyone else even voted for. And I'll have to tweet that out after the podcast is over. Because there was somebody who, but I don't want to like go all too well, personal cheese ball for the whole 150. But I do think it's interesting that we each have our guys that we're going to look out for. You know, like Ben Revere was a guy who I have in the top 100, who everyone voted for in their 150, but no, he didn't have enough support to get in the top 100.
And Ben Revere is another example. I should probably wrap this up, but he's also a point that it also is true as guys move up.
Mm-hmm.
And I've had scouts tell me this, and it's true. As guys move up, warts become more apparent, and things that guys can do become almost expected.
That's true. You're looking. You're
and
looking
Ben Revere is the example of that, in that Ben Revere is what he is.
That's right.
And what Ben Revere is a guy who hit for average, who can run.
Steal some bases.
Not the ideal profile, though, because he's probably not a center fielder, you'd say?
If he's a center fielder, you need really good left and right fielders.
Right. So that's probably more of a left.
Yeah, probably.
And if he's a left fielder, then you're saying, okay, well.
If he's your center fielder, if he's in your starting outfield, your other two outfielders better hit for power because you're going to get no power out of Ben Revere.
Right.
I mean, and when he was drafted, and even in his first year, the Twins were saying, we think this guy's going to have 40 or even maybe 50 power. And at that time, late, early in his career, you could give the Twins the benefit of the doubt on that. You really just can't do that anymore.
But
the thing is, the Twins don't even say that anymore.
And that's the thing is that a guy like that, so what happens is it's interesting, is a guy like that can almost kind of fall in the prospect rankings.
As he's rising
to
the minor league.
Not because he's failed to do essentially what he did all along. He's the same player success-wise as he was when he showed up.
He's a 60 hit for average guy.
But the thing about it is that what happens is that as the years tick away, you start taking away projections that you could wish on with a guy go away.
Unless the Twins, I mean, like just for the Twins, unless, say, Joe Benson comes up the big leagues for the next couple of years and gives him a power-hitting right fielder, and they would decide they want to move Denard Span to left and install Ben Revere in center, they better be getting some real power. Luke Hughes better be their everyday second baseman hitting 15 to 20 bombs a year for that alignment to work. I don't think the Twins, I don't think it works for them to have two of their three outfielders not hit for power.
But that's where
Ben Revere is. His best case scenario is Juan Pierre.
And the thing about it is that that's the example, though, of as a guy moves up, you take more projection away, but you add certainty. So that's why more of the floor guys who are going to make it are going to be, because when Ben Revere was breaking in, he was more of a ceiling guy.
Yeah, no doubt, because you were believing in at least that 40-ish power.
And the reality is that another guy in the Twin system, you talk about Aaron Hicks is, the time is ticking on that. You can only project that this incredible athlete is going to be an impact player for so long. At some point, you have to start seeing the impact come along a little more.
This is a pretty big year for him, and it's always you're putting these expectations on a guy. He's going to play in the Florida State League in a big league spring training park where you can't expect him to put up big power numbers. I mean, the main thing is to see him get off to a good start, not that 1-for-30 bull he gave you last year. Get off to a good start at Fort Myers and see if he can earn a promotion at midseason and kind of get kickstarted back to where you're starting to be able to project him as a star again as opposed to more of an everyday regular. Because right now he's looking more like a everyday regular with some flashes. Because there are not too many stars who repeated low class A. That track record is small in today's baseball. But that was a longish podcast, and not mean to go that long.
And I was going to say, and next week will probably be long again. We'll warn y'all because we're going to be talking top 100.
It could be. And like you said, we'll have chats, podcasts. We'll probably tweet. We just should release the top 100 one tweet at a time, Jamie.
No.
I don't think that'll
no.
work. But thank you for joining us here on the podcast. We're brought to you, as always, by MLB Network. You can go to baseballamerica.com store. With our MLB Network offer, that's 4 issues for $4. I'd say now's a good time to subscribe. Top 100, Major League Preview, Minor League Preview. I believe our opening day roster issue is the one after that. So now's a good time to subscribe, as any, to Baseball America Magazine. For J.J. Cooper, I'm John Manuel. We'll see you next time on the Baseball America Podcast. So long, everybody.